In that book of Nehemiah, there's a lot of things that are interesting, but the part that we're focusing on is the opposition that Nehemiah faced. Nehemiah had gone back to Jerusalem to rebuild the wall around the city. It's not necessarily a small city. It's actually a good-sized town that in his heyday, in his capacity, it held about 160,000 people. But at the time that Nehemiah went back, most of the houses were empty. There's not a whole lot of people there. Part of the reason for it was because there's no defense anymore for the city. And in the time that Nehemiah was there, they rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem that had been torn down completely in 52 days. And you start thinking about that project. It's not a small project. Not a huge number of workers. A good many, but not a huge number. In less than 2 months, they restored the walls of the city. Built it all the way back up. And we're not talking about putting a garden fence around the city. We're talking about walls that were probably 10, 20 feet high. Maybe 30. That's a lot of stone to move. And they weren't thin walls either, because they had to withstand sieges. Yet they did it in 52 days. And it wasn't that they just focused on the work, and that's the point I wanted to get through. They faced a lot of opposition. There were people that lived in the land that had no interest in Jerusalem being rebuilt. And they did all they could think of to discourage the people from building those walls. And it wasn't just problems outside, there were problems inside too. People were getting tired, they were getting overworked, they had people that were taking advantage of the fact that they were too busy working to actually grow food and gather food, and charging exorbitant rates and charging interest for borrowing money. All in 52 days. In chapter 6, which is where we had left off from Sunday night, in chapter 6, starting with verse 1, they had gotten to the point where they were close to finishing the wall. It still wasn't done, but it was getting close. And in Nehemiah chapter 6, starting with verse 1, it says, "Now it came about that when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Gishon, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall, and that no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not yet set up the doors in the gates, that Sanballat and Gishon sent a message to me, saying, 'Come, let us meet together at Shepharim, in the plain of Ono.' But they were planning to harm me." Nehemiah's work was nearly done, and the enemies realized they had not yet stopped it. The walls were basically finished. There were no gaps anymore. There was a solid wall now. The doors hadn't been put in yet, but it was there. And what they basically sought to do was subterfuge. "Come, let's talk. Let's get together. Let's basically compromise our position. Let's find a common ground between you and I." Nehemiah, though, understood that their interest was not in the building up of the walls of Jerusalem. When they asked for him to come, they were asking for some reason to stop what was happening. And here's his answer in verse 3. "So I sent messengers to them, saying, 'I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?' And they sent messengers to me 4 times in this manner, and I answered them in the same way." They kept pressing over and over again. "We want to talk. We want to get together." But there wasn't anything to talk about. In fact, to give credence to the request would mean they had something to offer. What did these people have to offer Nehemiah and his people? At best, it would take time away from the labor. That's what Nehemiah answers with. I'm too busy. I have work to get done. And I don't have time to go run off to some other place to talk to you. At the worst, it was a trap. And most likely that's what they had planned. Get them away from the fortifications of Jerusalem. Get them away from all the other people that sympathize with them. And then spring the trap. We need to understand as we're working as a church that we have a great work ahead of us. And it hasn't stopped. And there are innumerable time wasters in this world. We need to recognize that dealing with people that have no interest in helping, learning, or aiding will do anything for us but waste our time. I've run into a lot of people who have no other desire than to argue. They have some idea and they'd like to just bounce it off people and see how they do. They have no interest in the answer. They really have, they're not going to change their mind. But they like to argue points. I have an uncle that's like that. And the interesting thing is, no matter how well you prepare your answer, and how much thought you put into it, no answer is good enough. This is where you start getting the hint. No matter what you answer, it's never good enough. And if you don't watch out, pretty soon they consume all your time. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, there's a warning for us. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Starting with verse 3. It says, if anyone advocates a different doctrine and does not agree with sound words, those of our Lord Jesus Christ, and with a doctrine conforming to godliness, he is conceited and understands nothing, but he has a morbid interest in controversial questions and disputes about words, out of which arises envy, strife, abusive language, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of depraved mind and deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. There are people like that out in the world. We need to understand that. There are people that ask questions, and when you point out that they're really not interested in an answer, they just say, well, I only asked a question. Well, ask questions because you want to learn something. Either what I understand or to come to a common understanding, but to constantly poke holes, that's not interesting. That's not useful. And notice what he says about those people, exactly what Nehemiah did. Withdraw yourself. Don't have anything to do with it. It's a waste of time. In 2 Timothy, chapter 2, 2 Timothy 2, verse 14, remind them of those things and solemnly charge them in the presence of God not to wrangle about words, which is useless, and leads to the ruin of the hearers. Be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth. But avoid worldly and empty chatter, for it will lead to further ungodliness. A classic example that maybe we could give as something that would befall this thing. Back in the long time ago, Middle Ages, there were people that would spend hours debating how many angels could be stand on the head of a pin. Who cares? It's really what we ought to look at and say, who cares? Does it make any difference? Does it accomplish a goal? Does it bring us closer to Christ? It doesn't matter how many angels can stand on the head of a pin. There's tons of time wasters. Questions that people will come up with and ask that really don't want an answer. Other than they consume your time. And we got to understand, this is one of Satan's ploys to keep us from accomplishing what we need to get done. Just because someone claims to want to study, it doesn't mean they want to learn. And don't let such people distract you from profitable work. Now there's another opposition that came up in Nehemiah chapter 6. We're down to verse 5. I should remember to put a bookmark in my Bible. Nehemiah chapter 6. And in verse 5 it says, "Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a fifth time with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, 'It is reported among the nations, and Geshemu says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore you are rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king, according to these reports, and that you have also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king according to these reports. So come now, let us take counsel together.'" That's what they're trying to do. There's arm twisting going on. If you don't come down here and talk to us, we're going to go tell the king you're trying to make yourself a king. Attacks become more personal. Either you meet with us, we'll tell everybody you're planning to rebel. And you have people announcing as prophets that you are now going to become king. And we have testimony. We have evidence. We have somebody who was personally assigned to that. They heard you say this. And notice how this is disguised in a letter of concern. An open letter. I heard it been said. Look at Nehemiah's answer in verse 8. "Then I sent a message to him saying, 'Such things as you are saying have not been done, but you are venting them in your own mind. For all of them are trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands.'" Nehemiah's answer was short and to the point. You're making this up. It wasn't what you said. Charge wasn't true. Nehemiah basically saw that they were trying to undermine his confidence and thus slow down the work. You have to understand that when you make progress that another person opposes, it's not unusual for attacks to become personal. Attacks on your own reputation. In fact, that passage we had read for us in Psalm 35, take a look at verse 19. Psalm 35, starting with verse 19. "Do not let those who are wrongfully my enemies rejoice over me, neither let those who hate me without cause wink maliciously. For they do not speak peace, but they devise deceitful words against those who are quiet in the land. And they've opened their mouth wide against me, and they say, 'Aha, aha, our eyes have seen it.'" This is exactly what Nehemiah was facing. People making charges, claiming to have seen things that really didn't exist. They were involved in slander. We see this all the time in political campaigns. Eventually one candidate fears his rival's too strong, and then we start talking about it. We even got a word for it. Out comes the mud. They start slinging mud. Because they figure if you sling enough of it, something's bound to stick. Don't let lies distract you from your work or make you question what you're doing. We have to be strong in God and not fear. In fact, take a look at Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 10. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. There is where we have to rely. We have to rely that God will see two things. You know, the wall was almost done, and they're down to just the gates. There's not much left to stop this project. And they try one more desperate thing. In Nehemiah chapter 6 and verse 10, "And when I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Methabel, who was confined at home, and he said, 'Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they're coming to kill you, and they're coming to kill you at night.'" Basically, unknown to Nehemiah, somebody that was in his own camp was a sympathizer with the other people. And he said, all these threats, there has to be something behind it. They're planning to kill you. Let's go hide in God's temple. What he was trying to do was get Nehemiah into a compromising position. He tried to get Nehemiah to think that somebody was about to assassinate him, so he ought to take refuge in the temple. He even had someone prophesy regarding this event and the attempt. They're going to do it at night. Somebody said this. In doing so, what they're trying to do is take advantage of what they saw as Nehemiah's cautious nature. See, they had tried to say, hey, come, let's meet over this town. They've asked several times. Nehemiah kept saying no. They just thought he was being overly cautious. He was too fearful to come out. Well, let's play on the fear and get him to go hide. What they were trying to do, if you don't understand, is they're trying to get Nehemiah to appear to be a coward. See, they really didn't have anything to stick against Nehemiah. But they thought if they could get him to hide out in the temple, now they got evidence they could point to the other people. Hey, look, Nehemiah hides. Look at Nehemiah's answer in verse 11. "But I said, should a man like me flee? And could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Then I perceived that surely God had not sent him. But he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, so that they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. Remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these words of theirs. And so Nodiah the prophetess and the rest of the prophets who are trying to frighten me." Why should someone who trusts in God hide? Why should someone with God on his hand retreat? In Psalm chapter 11, look at verse 1. Psalm 11, and in verse 1, "In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain?" Sometimes I sing the song, but sometimes I don't think we understand what it's about. Why should we hide? Why should we tremble when God's with us? And in essence, what Nehemiah said is, you know what? If I die, I'd rather die working for God than trying to preserve my life in fear. Take a look at Proverbs. Proverbs 28. Proverbs 28 and verse 1. The wicked flee when no one is pursuing, but the righteous are as bold as lions. One of the things you see as a symptom of wicked people is they're always cautious. They're always fearful. I remember dealing with some young men that were troubled youth. And I always thought it was amusing that every time a police car came by, they got really nervous. I kept saying, well, what did you do? What wrong did you do that makes you so cautious? There's nothing to fear there. Well, never believe me. But told me something about their attitude, about their own mind. Righteous people have nothing to fear. What's the worst somebody can do to you? Kill you? Okay, so we go to God a little sooner. We're only here a few years anyway, relatively. Compared to eternity, this is nothing. That's why the righteous can be bold. In answering this false prophet, Nehemiah realized that this man was a hireling of his enemies. See, Nehemiah's enemies understood that perception can't be a weapon. That's why leaders and prophets were told that they had to put on a strong face when they faced the opposition. Take a look at Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 1. Jeremiah is told he's going to go talk to people that are not going to listen to him. And look at verse 17. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 17. Now gird up your loins and arise and speak to them all that I command you. Do not be dismayed before them, lest I dismay you before them. Now behold, I have made you today as a fortified city, and as a pillar of iron, and as walls of bronze against the whole land, to the kings of Judah, to his princes, to his priests, and to the people of the land, and they will fight against you. But they will not overcome you, for I am with you to deliver you, declares the Lord. The whole land is going to turn out against you, from the kings down to the least common person. Do not act dismayed before them. There's a reason for that. Don't show fear. In fact, God basically says, you show fear, I'll give you something to fear. Take a look at Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a contemporary of Jeremiah, only he was in Babylon, in captivity. Also a prophet of God, also telling people things they didn't want to hear. In Ezekiel chapter 2, and in verse 6. And you, son of man, neither fear them nor fear their words, though thistles and thorns are with you, and you sit on scorpions, neither fear their words nor be dismayed at their presence, for they are a rebellious house. I don't care what they do to you. They start slapping you with thorns, make you sit on top of scorpions, don't you show any fear. They didn't do that. But it's trying to give an illustration of, you know, people will bite back. They won't be always accepting. You know, we're told to do exactly the same. Take a look at 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13. First Peter 1, verse 13, it says, "Therefore, gird your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ." It's the same idea. Keep your wits about you. Keep sober. Keep your eye on the goal. Over in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 2. It says, "But after we had already suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know, we had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid much opposition." We've been talking about going out and spreading the word more actively. The more active you are, the more oppositions you're going to get. You've got to expect that. So what happens when we were so fortunate to get the town so riled up that they were against us? Go hide in a corner again? We need to trust in God. See, despite the opposition, the wall was done in just 52 days. Nehemiah said in chapter 6, verse 15. Just think that Nehemiah faced all these attacks, all those problems, while undertaking a huge task, all in less than 2 months' time. Now think about the excuses that you give as to why you can't do the Lord's work. Why you can't remain faithful. Why you just want to give up. See, are you letting the enemy's opposition keep you from doing what you know is right? There's one reason why that wall went up in 52 days. The people knew exactly what the goal was, and they worked on it. Nothing distracted them. They had hardships. They had difficulties, without a doubt. But they even knew what they were going after. And they worked at it. We have to be exactly the same. We need to know our purpose. We need to know what we're after. And we need to work together to accomplish the goal. Now, if we want the congregation to grow, it won't depend on me. Not by myself. I just can't do it. It's not going to depend on any one person or five people. But a lot more will get done. It's a group of us working together towards a common goal of seeing that God's word is spread in this community. I hope you'll think about that thought. Consider it as we go on through in the future weeks. There's an opportunity right now, though, that we have a time that as we gather together, that if there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God, would like the prayers of the brethren on their behalf. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song selected.